I found then and still today, it is the most interesting mountain that I've ever skied. I mean, it's large. The tree skiing is world renowned. And as the snow base builds up, the mountain just continues to change. It's like a sunset. You know, some days it just gets prettier and prettier as you go from 1 meter to 2 meters to 3 meters. And it's so large. We have six interconnected mountains. It could take a lifetime to ski this whole mountain if you were just visiting a couple times a year.
Welcome to the storm. I'm your host, Stuart Winchester, back to BC today and the first stop on the Powder Highway. Before we get there, I want to acknowledge and thank my paid subscribers. Listening to this podcast 7 days before anyone else is one of the many benefits that comes along with your paid Storm subscription. I do appreciate anyone who's listening to this podcast, however, and those same benefits are waiting for you if and when you decide to invest in a paid Storm subscription. The podcast, just so you understand, is only a small part of the Storm Skiing newsletter. I am consistently writing the most comprehensive breakdowns of ski news and trends in the entire United States, and the article previews that you're seeing now are only, at most, about 20% of a typical Storm Skiing Journal article. To get that full experience, please help yourself to an upgrade, which comes with the intangible benefit of helping to ensure the future of ski journalism that is about more than stoke and bro culture. You know, the lift-serve skiing universe that 99% of us actually inhabit and care about. So please head over to stormskiing.com where you can upgrade to the paid tier, or if you're not signed up at all, at least get in on the free version. You can also follow the Storm on Twitter/X, Instagram, and Threads at @StormSkiJournal. All right, before we get to Red Mountain, I want to talk about one of my very favorite products and one that is an indispensable part of my ski day, Hotronix ski boot foot warmers and heated socks. You know what I love? Skiing. Obviously. You know what I hate? Cold feet. And I'm one of those people whose feet get cold even when it's like 50 degrees and everyone's lapping slush. I used to suffer through it. I don't anymore. Why? I hooked myself up with Hotronix XLPC foot warmers in my ski boots. If you've had Hotronix before, I want you to know that the updated C series is the best on the market. With a new, larger anatomical shape, but with smaller, lighter batteries that perform in temperatures down to 22 degrees below zero. Or if you are looking for a less intrusive solution, consider Hotronix XLP heated socks. These socks offer the best size to capacity ratio and longevity on the market, with up to 18 hours of continuous heating power, and they will fit into your existing ski boots without issue. And here's an awesome feature. I love this. This new generation of Hotronix products is Bluetooth enabled, meaning you can manage them from the Hotronix Heat app. It's time to ditch the tough guy mentality. Skiing should not be an exercise in managing discomfort. Hook yourself up with Hotronix boot warmers or heated socks this ski season. Click the link in the banner on the podcast article to get started. Episode 163, Howard Katkov, CEO and Chairman of Red Mountain, British Columbia. If you're listening to this podcast, surely you're familiar with BC's famous Powder Highway and the legendary resorts that dot it. Revelstoke, Kicking Horse, Fernie, Kimberley, Whitewater, Panorama. But if you're coming north from the US, your likely first stop will be Red Mountain. And Red is not what most US skiers will be expecting from a large resort. In fact, it's more like what they may have expected out of Snowbird or Jackson Hole or Palisades Tahoe 30 or 40 years ago. That is to say, lots of space, lots of powder, and not a lot of company. Skiing Red is, in some ways, a time machine to an almost extinct form of skiing. Sure, there are compromises. You have to work to get there. There's no I-70 equivalent dropping you on Red's doorstep. And the lift fleet is all fixed grip. No detaches, even with nearly 3,000 feet of vert. But frankly, if that's a deal breaker for you, there are plenty of other places where you can go wait in line to ride those fast lifts. Red is something different, something special, and we will learn why today. Let's go. My guest today has been CEO and chairman of the board of Red Mountain Ventures, owners of Red Mountain, British Columbia, for 20 years. With 3,850 acres of skiable terrain on a 2,919 foot or 890 meter vertical drop, Red is the fourth largest ski area in Canada and the ninth largest in North America. As the southernmost resort on Canada's famed Powder Highway, Red averages 300 inches or 760 centimeters of snow per winter. Prior to investing in Red in 2004, he founded and led a succession of successful startups, including Doc 3, Jane Cosmetics, and legal and real estate investment companies. Howard Kotkov is my guest. Howard, welcome to the storm. Red is a special, special place, and I am so fired up to get into it with you. How are you doing today, Howard? How's life?
Good morning, Stuart. It's a pleasure to be on. Life is good today, as all days, and I'm happy to be part of your podcast. I'm looking forward to it.
So we're here, we're talking for the listeners on February 8th. It was a little bit of a rough start to the season all over the continent. How's it shaping up, though? How are you feeling about the 2023-24 ski season at Red 2 months in, 3 months in?
Well, certainly the opening of the season, I should just say December per se, was very tough. Tough for us and frankly tough for many, many ski resorts. Anybody who owns a ski resort or works at a ski resort, we all feel the same pain. Our goal is to a ski resort to ski. We're all in the same boat. And, you know, fortunately, we are past that time period. Red is skiing extremely well right now. It has been snowing off and on for the last several weeks. And we're just looking forward to rolling up our sleeves and continuing to provide the best service we can to our customers.
So Red is known for those epic powder days. Any good days you've had so far? What's been your best memory of the season so far?
So I am known on a powder day to get in line with the locals and the people who are visiting, spend a half hour in the lift line and go ski for a few hours before work. I've had many good powder mornings. I think the one that stands out this year, I was on Gray Mountain on a run called Corey's, and it was at least a foot of untracked, and there was a gentleman about 50 yards to the right of me skiing, and we both stopped at the end of the run. I was waiting for a friend of mine, and he looked at me, and I had my name tag on my coat, and he said, "This is the best ski day I've ever had in my life. Wow. You all be very proud of this place." So that stands out this year.
Where's your go-to on a powder day? Do you like Motherlode? Do you like to stay on Gray Mountain? Do you like to hop around Paradise? Do you have a routine, or you just kind of go where you think it's best that day?
What's interesting about our mountain is the direction of the wind. So it could snow 10 centimeters, yet it could blow in 30 on the north side. So depending upon the weather, but I like the trees of granite, powder fields, jumbo, slides, pale face. I like the trees through Paradise, and I love Gray Mountain. I mean, Gray Mountain was a fantastic addition, and it provides so much additional skiing, whether it's trees or open glades.
Do you try to get out every day?
I get out every day that it snows.
Something new to the mountain this year, the revamped Red Mountain Express bus service, and it will take you between Roslyn and the ski area for free. Talk about this service, what it was like before, how you improved it, and why you made these changes.
Let's step back. I mean, you know, a shuttle service is a very key component to benefit the locals, staff, and also our customers. And for several years, ending last year, we had a 14-seat shuttle. It had four stops. It cost $3 a ride. For staff, it was a $75 pass. For the public, it was a $150 pass. And it just wasn't cutting it. And one of my managers came to me and said, "I think we ought to kick this thing up." So this year we launched a 44-seat shuttle. It has 14 stops versus four. And we chose to make it free. And just, I think yesterday, we had 280 people on that shuttle from 7 a.m. to 3:30. It's extremely popular. And it really is something that to us is somewhat of a give back to the community and as a added bonus to the people who come and visit.
So what went into that calculus to make it free? Did you look at the benefits beyond the income that will come in? In other words, things like there would be fewer cars on the road, it would create goodwill. Kind of take us through that decision and ultimately why that made sense to you.
There's many facets to this decision. I mean, first of all, it relieves pressure on parking for those people who actually live in Roslyn. It also provides a great service for our staff, many of which are, you know, from foreign countries that don't have cars. It provides a great service for them. And it also provides a great service for the businesses of our community in Roslyn. I mean, we're 3.5 kilometers away. We're joined at the hip with that community. And it was, we didn't subsidize the entire investment. Tourism Roslyn contributed, several businesses contributed, we contributed. And it's just been, frankly, a home run. And but so, you know, it benefits everybody. And many, many of the businesses and the nonprofits contributed towards the success of this.
How many buses are you running?
We're running one bus. Big, but it turns around every 40 minutes. So it's, and it's working. And then in addition, we have a shuttle at night. And for the people who might have had too much to drink at Rafters, our bar, or downtown.
The mass transit's good for that, for sure. So you mentioned Del Mar. You're a California guy originally. Is that where you grew up? Did you grow up skiing down there?
I grew up in Southern California. So I grew up in Palos Verdes and Corona Del Mar. I grew up surfing. So I started surfing in 1959. And I did somewhat of a detour in high school, putting the books aside for surfing. Yet I did rebound. I started skiing when I was 16 on a school ski trip to Mammoth Mountain. Okay. And, you know, at that time there were two T-bars, two chairlifts. You could see the McCoy sisters practice racing on T-bar, and it was $4 a day.
So thinking back to that first day at Mammoth, was that a crucial moment for you? Did you get the bug that day, or was that just, okay, it was your first time skiing and then you kind of caught on to it later? How crucial was that bus trip to Mammoth to sort of leading you down this life where you would eventually play such a big part in skiing?
Well, I mean, I actually remember the first day. I knew nothing about skiing, and I went to a thrift store and bought, I think it was a 220 Vocal racing ski. I weighed 135 pounds. This is when we wore jeans. You sprayed waterproofing on your jeans and you had, you know, these boots that had the little strap in the back. So when I put those on, I literally remember this today. I went down, I was just on this road next to the school bus and hit the school bus. Not hard. I didn't think I had an epiphany that moment. We started to ski more and more, and it really changed when I went to undergrad at University of Nevada, Reno. And this started to fall in love with the sport a lot.
So up in Reno, I mean, you have all the choices in the world. Did you hit Mount Rose? What was your kind of go-to when you were up at school there?
So yeah, we had mandatory PE for 2 years, and mine was skiing Mount Rose. That was nice. One of the courses. But, you know, I watched Tahoe develop. I was there at the first day Kirkwood opened. We skied Squaw Valley when there was nobody there. You could literally drive around the lake in the winter without traffic. It was paradise.
I mean, when you think back to that in your sort of formative years skiing, is that kind of what you were missing when you found red? Was that sort of frontier feeling of emptiness in a big mountain?
It was a combination of that. And, you know, I had at the time, I still have, I have four kids. Now they're all married and they're three grandchildren. And so I grew up at a time where skiing was, it wasn't really anti-culture, but it was very organic. It was very old school. It was owned privately by, you know, people that had a huge vested interest in their place. They were part of the canvas. And I mean, for example, you know, we had a Volkswagen bus. My friends and I would drive to Mammoth. We'd park in the parking lot and spend the night. We'd sneak into ski patrol and take showers. And it just had this old school feeling that never left me. So I, in about 1995 to 2000, I started thinking about building a retirement house. I was just about getting out of my cosmetic company, but I sold Estee Lauder. And a friend of mine named Jack Carey for 5 years told me about Red Mountain. And I had been looking at real estate all over the West. And after 5 years of explaining to me why I should go there, I went there with my wife, didn't know a soul, didn't ski that day. This was February 1st of 2000. And I bought some lots and started building a house.
So take us from there. I mean, did you have any buyer's remorse, or how long did it take you to realize you made the right decision?
Well, I remember driving home the next day with my wife to the airport, and we actually both looked at each other and said, what have we done? I mean, the town was very small, and we didn't know a soul. We met a few people, and it was raining. And we just started building. And over a couple of years of building, we got to meet people, and I started skiing this mountain and realized what a special place it was. I mean, when you go to a community that's 140 years old, it's the third oldest ski resort in North America that has a passion for their mountain. You just don't drop in. You have to kind of earn your place at the dinner table. And it doesn't take much to earn your place. You just have to be a non-pretentious, good person that loves the outdoors. And so over time, we just found that this community was so engaging, so embracing, that we fell in love with it. And our children fell in love with it. And our grandchildren now are in love with it.
So let's focus on the mountain for a moment. You didn't ski the first time you went there. When you did ski, what did you find? I mean, it sounds like you'd skied all over. You had some good context on what else was out there. What made Red special to you?
The variety of terrain. Well, step back. First of all, the first thing that struck me when I started skiing there was, I'm not as good a skier as I thought I was. Because everybody, you know, people, these parents put their kids on skis sometimes before they learn to walk.
Right.
But that was slightly sobering. But what I found then and still today, it is the most interesting mountain that I've ever skied. I mean, it's large. The tree skiing is world renowned. We have pure 2,500 foot vertical on our main chairlifts, almost 3,000 total. And as the snow base builds up, the mountain just continues to change. It's like a sunset. You know, some days it just gets prettier and prettier as you go from 1 meter to 2 meters to 3 meters, because the coverage starts to, you know, eliminate cliff bands and like that. It's never boring, and it's so large. We have, you know, six interconnected mountains that there are some people, you could take a lifetime to ski this whole mountain if you were just visiting a couple times a year.
So you arrived in 2000, and you mentioned that you started surfing in 1959. So there's a big space in there. And before we get into how you got into owning Red Mountain, I'm curious what your background was and how that kind of prepared you over time to take on this big project of running a ski area.
I have started seven companies, so I don't want to dominate this hour with my life, but I'll give you the quick nutshell. As I said, I surfed instead of studied in high school. So I had to crawl my back way into school, ended up at University of Santa Cruz in 1969 and had this girlfriend. And this was when it was the right in the middle of free everything. And I realized if I didn't get out of that school, I would not actually maybe survive. And I ended up, a woman friend of mine said, "Hey, I'm going to University of Nevada, Reno." And I said, "That sounds good." And I applied, got accepted, drove in the biggest snowstorm that I, to this day, I've ever driven in, and ended up in Reno and completely enjoyed my experience. I worked extremely hard and kind of turned, I wouldn't say turned my life around, but just got serious. And then I went to law school and came out of law school and started my own law firm in 1976 with one of my law school friends. And I did that for 8 years. I was a real estate entitlement attorney, ended up going into business with one of my clients. And from 84 to 90, we built over 3,000 houses, almost, I think, $750 million of real estate. We were quite successful. And then the recession of 90 showed up and I turned the page of that chapter of my life. Got out standing up, but learned many lessons. And from there, I was asked to go on a board of a cosmetic organizer company called Sassaby, which I did. I learned the retail mass market business, the Walmarts and Targets of the world. And after a couple of years, I noticed that nobody was speaking to the young women, the teens of today. Christie Brinkley was the spokesperson at the time for CoverGirl, and she was 40 years old, and that was a teen brand. So I launched this brand called Jane Cosmetics, and was my first Silicon Valley private equity backing. And that was a 10-year run. But we were the fastest growing cosmetic brand in America 4 years in a row, and ended up from zero to 23,000 stores. And in October 31st of 1997, I sold it to Estee Lauder, and I worked for Leonard for 3 years. And that was a very good experience, very hard, a lot of work, but fulfilling. Then I went on the board and helped raise money for a internet service, concierge service called Doc3 with a couple of brainiacs named Finbar Sheehy and Thomas Buchenbach, who are PhDs from Caltech in astrophysics and electrical engineering. They had this idea. And that, we were just a little bit ahead of our time. The brand still is out there, but I wouldn't call that a great success, a great service, but just early on. And then I was building my house up in Roslyn in 2002. And someone said to me, "Did you hear the ski resort is in a little bit of trouble and I'm building a ski house?" And just to give it some history, it was a co-op from 1948 till 1986. So it was owned by the community. And then six guys bought it in 86. And in 2002, one had passed away, one was on dialysis. They were just, you know, older guys. And for some reason I said, well, maybe I should just put together a group and buy this ski resort. And I started going after it, and it's really when 9/11 showed up, because it was under contract with some guys in Toronto. And then when 9/11 happened, it fell out. And I put it under contract in September of 03. And because of my land planning expertise, we and my partner, who is also in the land business, and we flipped the zoning from 400 units to 1,300 units and amended the official community plan, then flipped the zoning and closed the transaction with a small group of investors in June 4th of 2004.
That's such an interesting story. And I have to point out some parallels between your story and Wynn Smith at Sugarbush. Wynn Smith had also been a businessman. He was based in New York City. He actually closed on the sale of Sugarbush on September 11th, 2001. So he was someone who did not come up in the ski industry, similar to you, but had acquired other, call them administrative or executive skills to be able to lead large teams of people. So when you step into this, obviously you're a skier, but I think most skiers figure out pretty quick that they don't know a lot about running a ski resort just because they know how to ski. So how were you able to take all this experience you had from all these different industries and all the different skills you built up and apply that to running Red Mountain?
Well, first of all, you surround yourself with really smart people, people that are smarter than you. Number two, I bought a resort that had an incredibly dedicated staff of people who had been there in some cases 45 years. So I walked into an operating model that was functioning pretty well. It certainly had not had a lot of capital investment in the previous years since prior to when I bought it. But, you know, for me, I am an example, and anybody can follow this example, of if you just put your head into something, absorb it as much as you can, learn from the people around you, you can get into any category as long as it doesn't have science applied to it for me. And I just did that. And the second piece is, and in 2004, 5, and 6, that's when the boomers were buying real estate at resorts, golf and ski, you know, as like they were on crack. And, you know, I came there with a vast development experience. And so our economic model at the time was very similar to every other, you know, ski owner's model, which was you build real estate, you make money, and you keep the merry-go-round going, you know, as an amenity for your real estate purchaser. And that model, and that's how we started. I mean, we built a 67-unit project. I sold multiple pieces of land between 2004 and 2000 and late 7, and things were going very well. And then the recession of 2008 showed up. So I don't know if I answered your question, but to me, it's just immersing yourself in the category that you're in, learn as much as you can from others, and trust your judgment as well. I mean, you have to feel confident enough that you can come into this category or any category and succeed.
Yeah, and I want to pick up on the last piece of that here, Howard, the real estate bit, because you're right, that's what most ski areas were doing at the time. They were kind of building, not most, but a lot of skiers were sort of considering the skiing and amenity to real estate. And a lot of them got caught up in the recession. Revelstoke got a great start and sort of just development slammed to a halt there for a really long time. How were you able to pivot out of that? Because that's a pretty easy hole to fall into. But Red seemed to continue to grow, continue to thrive. And I think you probably had to step away from that real estate model for a little while. So, you know, drawing back on your other experience with businesses and being kind of flexible and dynamic, how were you able to weather that and keep Red going and change the model as you kept the lift spinning?
So the learning was from my real estate development experience in San Diego. So in 1989, I think I did $125 million of sales, sold and built almost 400 homes, was one of the largest borrowers, had 1500 lots. And when the recession hit, you know, it wasn't pretty. Like I said, I got out standing, but with certainly a reduced net worth. Having said that, and I personally guaranteed loans at the time. So what I learned, I had a saying when I was in my 40s with real estate, oh, you know, if you borrow more than you're worth, you're fine, because no one is ever going to chase you because there's nothing to get, right? And that was flawed. So, okay. You know, going into real estate development in Roslyn, I made sure of two things. Number one, I was not personally guaranteeing loans, and we were going to keep our debt, institutional debt, no matter what we were doing, whether it was real estate or capital improvements on the mountain, to a minimum, because I never wanted to have the legacy in Roslyn, the guy who bankrupted the ski resort. So even to this day, the amount of institutional debt that we have is extremely small. So I've managed the risk that way by keeping ourselves out of harm's way in terms of institutional debt.
So you've managed the mountain through 20 years of ups and downs, and certainly it's been an interesting time in history. I want to focus on Rosalind a little bit. And as you said, you've lived there for longer than you've owned the mountain. Often mountains and ski resorts and the historic towns that are there can have fraught relationships. We see that in Park City, where Vail's having trouble upgrading some lifts. We see that in Vail, where Vail Mountain is having some trouble building employee housing. How would you characterize the relationship between Rosalind and Red?
I would characterize it as very good. So the question is, why? You know, my mindset as a CEO is to protect something that I personally love very much. And what I love is not, it's not just the ski resort, it's the community of Rosalind, that I'm a custodian of their most favorite and economically important asset, the ski mountain. But it's more than that. It's an endangered species, this place. I mean, when I was a kid, there were a lot of red mountains out there in terms of just local, huge community support and just this vibe that we all fell in love with and was such a big part of why we loved skiing then and loved it today. And when I recognized that, wow, a place like this still exists, when I became CEO, a fiduciary duty, you know, came with the purchase of not disenfranchising this community and enhancing the community while you enhance the ski experience. And that's a balance. And I can't say that I've made everybody happy, but I'm confident that plus 90% of this community is happy with the direction we've taken for the last 20 years in protecting what they've loved for over 100 years. I mean, I have people, my new CFO was born and raised in Rosalind. His father was born and raised in Rosalind. So it's everything I do, I always have in the back of my mind impact on the community. And it's not always easy. And I'll give you an example of a mistake that I made in this 20 years. It was about 2008. And I thought, you know, it'd be great to put a golf course on our property. We have 4,200 acres of what we call controlled rec area, which is like BLM for the U.S. And I met Annika Sorenstam and signed her up for her first signature golf course. I hired a man named Tom McBroom, extremely famous Canadian golf architect, hired the best environmental people in North America, because I felt that this would be a great accretive addition to our community. And obviously, back to that economic model of, you know, real estate around golf courses, real estate around ski resorts. So, you know, we spent a year and a half on that. And what happened is that this golf course was in part of the overall watershed. And one of our efforts was to see if we could build a pesticide-free golf course. And the answer is you couldn't. I mean, with the greens, there's a thing called snow mold. And the only way you get rid of snow mold is a certain kind of pesticide. So it really triggered a lot of outrage in the community for a year, culminating in my city council meeting where I think a couple hundred people marched down the main street. And I walked into the city council and I sat down and a woman comes in and sits next to me. She's breastfeeding her baby, and she looks at me and says, "You're going to kill my baby." And this is a long story, Stuart, but here's the end of it, and shows you, you know, kind of how I am personally. We got an 8-to-1 approval of our project that night, and once we received their approval, I stood up. And I said to the council and to the people there, "I'm withdrawing my application." And I did. I don't think people believed me for months. And And I withdrew it because it was wrong for this community. No matter how much I invested in making this thing as environmentally perfect as possible, it was impossible. Secondly, it just triggered this anger in this community that I'd never seen before or after. And I humbly just said to my partners, this is over. So that's an example of understanding something that you felt was good intentioned that was just not right for this community.
So when you reflect on that experience, and I'm not sure where that fell on the timeline, but when you went on to subsequent large projects like Gray Mountain or Topping Creek and doing those expansions, how did that change your approach to the community engagement to maybe head off some of those less good feelings in advance?
So that was 2008. And, you know, 2008 per se was just a 9 and 10, you know, was not a healthy time for the ski industry. I mean, we know there's carnage there, including, you know, Revelstoke original owners and Interwest and Fortress. And I can go on and on. So, you know, I kind of put that behind me, and I'm the type of person that I'm man enough to stand up and say, I made a mistake. I'm sorry, but I don't dwell on it. I move on. So what do I learn from this experience? So because real estate had really kind of disappeared from a resort point of view for several years, I then focused on the operating company, the resort. Said, okay, it's time to expand this place. And that's in 2013, we decided to open up Gray. And that at the time was the biggest single expansion of an existing ski resort in over 45 years. So it's 1,000 acres, 360 degrees skiing, one chair lift. You know, it's as big as Mount Hood. And, you know, I have two partners that are both in, you know, director of planning and president of planning that have an incredibly strong relationship with the city and the staff, and frankly, the community. My partner, Don Thompson's been there since 1979. Christine's been there actually since, I think, 4 years after I came there. But these people, you know, are my conduit to not just the community, but to the city to make sure that we do everything within our zoning rights, and we do everything environmentally to check the boxes. And, you know, our track record with the city in 20 years is 100%. So you gain respect by actions. And I certainly lost respect in 2008, but I started to incrementally gain respect because they realized he's just kind of like we are. And yet he just happens to have this job. But there are, you know, things that we remodeled the day lodge, and we have these almost 900 lockers in the dead best piece of real estate at our resort. And I've preserved those because those are the community lockers, and that is our connection with our community. And that connection with our community creates the connection to our visitors who get to meet and hang out with our community. And, you know, we also remodeled this old ski bar called Rafters, and they had pictures in there since 1948, many of which were families' children who had passed away, or husbands or sisters or brothers. And when we went in there to work on it, I took pictures of where every picture was, had them all reframed. And I remember the day we reopened it because they were locked out of the building. And there were 50 people waiting to get in, and they didn't go into their locker. They went upstairs to Rafters to see if their family picture was still there. And it was. So it's those little things that start to gain, you know, trust, I should say. And we've done a lot of other things that do that. We support the racers, Red Mountain Racers. You know, we support, you know, a free bus. we help people who are, you know, indigent. We help people who, you know, have been struck by, you know, tragedy, you know, not in huge ways, but we're always there participating as a community member, not as the ski owner, ski, you know, company.
So it sounds like you've done a lot to engage with the community and build up their trust. I'm really curious, Howard, to get your take on something that has been a big problem for these small mountain towns, ski towns in the U.S., which is housing and short-term rentals. And when I spoke to your peers, Pete Woods at Ski 3 and Darcy Alexander, who runs Sun Peaks, it seems like they have, in a lot of places in Canada, different sort of restrictions that help to curtail this problem. I'm curious what that dynamic is like in Rosslyn and in Red Mountain. I realize it's not something that you control directly, but I would love your insight into how that's impacting that community. This, you know, everything from remote workers that started during COVID to just the ease of turning your house into a hotel. How has Rosslyn been handling that? And is that an issue there as it is in Telluride and Park City and all these other ski towns in the U.S.?
Yeah, it's a big question, Stuart. Let me just give you my views. Short-term rentals is certainly something that is a hot button in not just ski resorts, but in urban areas. And our properties, we have approximately 900 units left to build in real estate. We are allowed to have short-term rental. And, you know, that's a big advantage for people who are considering to buy a piece of real estate, because if they're there 2 or 3 weeks a year, this is the way that they can, you know, kind of amortize their purchase and support their purchase, I should say. And so we're very fortunate to have that. And this is something supported by the Crown and supported by the government. Within the city of Rosslyn, it certainly has become an issue. And there are pros and cons to it. I mean, we have, I forget the exact number, but I think it's like 2% of our housing in the city of Rosslyn is short-term rental. So it's not huge. But it's, if you're next door to somebody that has that, it is huge. City Council, and I'm not going to opine too deeply on this, but they're definitely into this piece of it. Short-term rentals now require zoning, it requires permit. It's a lot harder to do short-term rental in the city of Rosslyn, because City Council today believes that it has a negative effect on the neighborhood community. And we're just a citizen watching that. And politically, it's a tricky question. But yeah, we're fortunate on that side of it. In terms of housing overall, and you touched upon it, COVID has dramatically changed and created this paradigm shift to remote working. I mean, in a way that none of us could ever have imagined. And Rosslyn became a beneficiary of that, because so many people in the lower mainland, or in some parts of the United States, want to live in a mountain community like Rosslyn and have bought homes and moved in permanently. So what that has done is taken the long-term rental opportunities for people like my staff, for instance, that's taken those products off the market. That's a problem that exists in all ski resorts. We're not as bad as some of those places you mentioned, where the real estate is so expensive, astronomically expensive, that you wouldn't even consider putting that in a rental pool. And so, but even today, with 350 people working at our resort, we have managed, with the support of the community and individual homeowners, you know, housed our staff. But having said that, we know that it's time to build our help build staff housing, looking for grants, working with the city, working with some other stakeholders. We have a lot of land, and we are absolutely amenable to find a partnership, whether it's with BC Housing or private enterprise, to do some staff housing at or around our base area.
So you have a lot of room to build, and you've done some really interesting things with making some more urban-like buildings where they're maybe smaller, but kind of steps to the resort. I'm curious about your master plan here, Howard, and how you're thinking about how you want to build your community at the base of the mountain, because too often I think we see suburban sprawl replicated in the mountains where it's just a bunch of McMansions and it doesn't really make sense. It seems like you have an opportunity to build kind of an interconnected, logical, walkable, pedestrian type village that suits all sorts of people. I don't know if that's your plan, but I know you're doing a lot of interesting things. So talk about your vision for what you can do at the base of Red Mountain, and then how you see that as complementing Roslyn rather than competing with it, if that makes sense. So you're not trying to draw away the vitality, but make another center where people can live.
Another complex question, but I'll start from the beginning. When we amended our official community plan in 2003 and four, we designed our, we call it a neighborhood. I'm not really a village guy, but we look at our neighborhood as an extension of our community of Roslyn. It's 3.5 kilometers away. It's connected by, you know, biking trails, hiking trails, walking trails. And, you know, first and foremost for me was don't disenfranchise the local community, the local businesses. One of the things we did when we amended our official community plan, we reduced our commercial footprint from, I think, 200,000 square feet to 70,000 square feet. Because we said, you know, we don't want to build another town. We have a town, quintessential town. What we want to do is add services or add businesses that complement, that don't compete. And that was our philosophy. The master plan itself, our vision is that base area has very few cars. Every building that we build there, you have to have underground parking. We have such a vast amount of property. Ultimately, we're going to have at the base area all of the parking across the entry. And we've, in the last 3 years, when we built Topping Creek Chairlift, we built another parking lot with another 450 parking places. So parking is very important, as you know, Stuart, it touches the nerve of many people at many resorts. And that's right. And so we, you know, we're focused on that piece of it as well. So our master plan to us is a neighborhood. My vision is that it's not a winter neighborhood, it's a four-season neighborhood, but it also has commerce there that's different than downtown, complements downtown, but also, you know, I can see down the road having a co-op workspace there where we have a lot of high tech in our region now where they can go rent 2,000 square feet at the base of one of the best ski resorts in North America and at noon go do 5 laps on the red chair and go back to work. So I see a neighborhood. I don't see a resort base area. I see something that is vibrant with people that live there full time, but also has this pedestrian feel and space that is just very appealing and not busy, condensed, and focused on pulling every dollar that you can from your customer while they're there that day. That's the first piece of it. You know, the second piece is we are going to really start to focus on the other three seasons of the year. And we are in design development of a bike park that could kick off this summer, designed by Gravity Works that did the 8th line at Whistler. We're looking at some other kind of wellness type amenities at the base. And for the specific purpose of just starting to create more commerce in those other three seasons that not only benefit, again, the ski resort, but the town. I mean, everything we do on this resort flows down to the town because these people who are visiting us, staying in our hotels, they want to go downtown. They want to experience that downtown. So we just try to be very compatible and homogeneous with what downtown represents and has to offer and what we represent and have to offer. And we just join them together in the best way we can.
One unique aspect of what you're doing, Howard, that I want to linger on for a moment is there's a lot of different price points. And some of these prices that I saw on your website and in different interviews that I've watched you do are far, far below what you would expect to get in a mountain community at all, let alone slopeside. Talk about that for a minute. How do you do that? How do you keep these things affordable? And why is that important to you to have that be a part of what you build?
Well, it starts out with the canvas of Red Mountain Resort has to represent many different demographics. I am not interested in catering to the 1% only. We like the 1%ers and they love coming to Red, but you know, they're wearing jeans, they're with their 3 to 4 kids, their average age is 40 something, they're adventure people. You wouldn't have a clue what they did in their life. They're here just to be outdoors, to be part of nature, right? Mm-hmm. But I also, the never ever, skiing is not cheap. And we want to make it accessible to those people as well, because those are the people that are going to grow this sport. And also, I want to give those people the opportunity to do something that we all love. So that's why we built 5 years ago, Nowhere Special, a 92 pillow, very modern hostel that is a minute and a half to the chairlift. And when we launched it, it was $40 a night, Canadian, to stay there.
Wow.
So, you know, that's our ethos, is to be accessible to everybody. And in between that, you know, we've built single family neighborhoods. We're building one called Caldera right now. We're in our fourth phase out of 5. Beautiful. It's 3-minute walk to the resort. Very modern aesthetic. And now 2 years ago, we launched a project called the Crescent, which is what you were referring to, the small footprint. And so I had this idea with my partner, Don, to take the urban to the alpine. Because cost of construction have just accelerated, especially during COVID, that we wanted to make it affordable. So we built 102 units, 80-some were 484 square foot studios. And they went out at $356,000 Canadian, $280-some thousand USD. At the base of the 9th largest ski resort in North America. And I would challenge you or anybody to say, impossible to find that at any resort, especially a resort in the top 10.
And it is, which leads me to ask, how do you keep the predators and the house flippers out? The folks who say, oh, okay, I'm going to buy 10 of those and turn them around for 3 times the price.
First of all, you can't flip during escrow while you're in the contract, but if you know, purchase a unit, it's you know, freedom to sell your unit. So someone can sell their unit, but they certainly can't flip during the time we're building. But you know what's interesting though, Stuart, people aren't flipping. The people who are bought, and it's also interesting, it's, I think the Crescent was 53-54% US buyers.
Wow.
And I launched the Daily just 3 weeks ago, which is a 94 unit project. And to today, 81% are US. And I think, the reason is the value proposition, but then also if you live in Washington, Oregon, or California, you cannot buy anything at a base of a ski resort. If a building even existed, a site, and if you could, it's not for starting at 500,000 Canadian. I mean, I will go on record to say I think we have the best pound for pound value proposition on a real estate purchase anywhere in North America. I would just say that.
And what drives you to make those affordable? Because you could probably get more for them. So I'd imagine it's not just a sense of altruism. I imagine there's a business reason behind it and a logic behind it. So what is it that makes you want to make that part of it, affordability?
Well, I mean, look, we're each of these partnerships that fund real estate development, like the two I'm doing now. I mean, these two projects are $170 million. There's another 78 townhomes that we're doing in partnership with these two guys from Vancouver. So when you raise equity and when you put a project to market, it has to pencil. It has to have a reasonable return on it, on the investment. I mean, we're not completely altruistic here. But having said that, it's just our cost and cost, whether it's land, construction, and margin, is such that we can offer on a relative basis an incredible value. And that's why you're seeing the U.S. people recognize this. I mean, the ski resort has finally come of age. I'm not an overnight success. I mean, I'm 20 years into this thing, but it's taken us, I mean, honestly, it's taken 15 years to really start to get the respect. And it's a combination of people recognizing how good this place is as a ski experience and as a community interaction, but it's also what's happened around the industry with just kind of the density of skiing, if you know what I mean. And so, you know, for me, it's about the elasticity curve, right? I mean, we don't need to push the elasticity curve just to make the most money we can possibly make. We want to give good value to our customer. A purchaser of real estate, we want them to say, wow, yeah, this is costing me a few dollars, but boy, it's just such a good value at a great place. And that's our philosophy.
So you've built a lot of really interesting stuff at the base of Red Mountain, and you have a lot of plans. You live in Rosslyn and really love the community. I can't help but notice how close Rosslyn is to Red Mountain. Curious if anyone has ever discussed building a lift up from town, a la Aspen or Telluride, so that, you know, maybe, I'm sure you could still have shuttle buses, but I haven't seen this in the master plan. Is this something anyone's ever talked about, being able to connect Rosslyn to Red Mountain directly?
Yeah, it's gone back a long ways, but I think in about 2005 or six, we were looking at grants to put a gondola from what they call the new city council is in town, up to the backside of Red Mountain, which is the original first chairlift. But we really don't need that. It's just you can drive to our resort, you can park your car and enjoy yourself. And you're talking about a population also of, you know, call it 4,000, 4,400 people. And, you know, those types of investments, I could do a lot more things with that kind of money than have I wouldn't call it gimmick, but it's just not kind of part of our brand, right? I just don't see it.
And what was the community sentiment around that? Were folks interested, or did they seem to want to just keep the mountain and the town as not interconnected entities?
You know, I can't even remember, Stuart. It was so long ago. I don't think it went very far to even surface as a viable option.
All right, let's talk about your ownership model here, Howard. I know this is going back a few years, but I think it's worth revisiting because it touches on so many of your pieces of philosophy of how you see Red Mountain and how you own Red Mountain and run it. And that's this campaign that you launched in 2016 called Fight the Man, Own the Mountain. Tell us about this campaign, how it worked, why you launched it, and ultimately what it was able to accomplish.
So one of my other companies that I was involved in, it's called Suenio, which was a online furniture company, very modern, eclectic brand. And I I jumped on the board of that just to make sure my daughter would stay in town, and she started working there and not moved to San Francisco. And during the couple of years that I was involved, we went to crowdfunding started to appear, right? And I went to Los Angeles to meet a guy who started Start Engine. And we went there to pitch Sueño to raise some money. And we're sitting there with him. His name's Howard Marks. And he was really not very interested in Sueño. And he looked at me and goes, "What do you do?" And I said, "Well, I own the ski resort in British Columbia." And he goes, "Ski resort? Well, who wouldn't want to own a ski resort? We should do a ski resort. Let's do your ski resort, not this furniture company."
Okay.
I said, "Well, Howard, no, I'm here representing these guys to do try to raise money for my furniture company." He goes, "Well, I'm not interested in your furniture company. I'm super interested in your ski resort. That would be okay. Incredible. So the entrepreneur that I am, I kind of thought about that. You know, we have a very small sales and marketing group. Eric Kerr has been with me on 13 years. He's not even 40, brilliant. And we have a copywriter out in Whigby Island in Seattle. And that's and we have several other people now, but at the time that was it. So I went back to Eric and I said, let's just see what this is like. Let's jump into this thing, but we'll do it very cost effectively. Because when I started getting into it, I went back to, you know, Start Engine, and I said, "So tell me what's entailed here. How do you get this thing disseminated to data?" He goes, "No, here's these data companies. Go talk to them." So I went and talked to a few of these companies that have basically, you know, list of people, right? And it was like $500,000-$600,000 each. I mean, I'm not doing that. So I said to Eric, "We're just going to do it grassroots." So we put together with Colin, our copywriter, this campaign. He named it Fight the Man, Own the Mountain. And at the time, they had what they call test the water. So you go out there with a campaign and people express a non-binding interest. And in a matter of 3 or 4 days, we got $12 million of interest. I forget how many thousands of people from 18 countries.
Wow.
And I went, "Wow, okay. So the next thing you have to do is then put together a securities document." And that's where the brain damage started. So that took another year. And we were the first company to do a crowdfunding for a ski resort, period. And I think still today. And we were the first company to do crowdfunding ever in two countries. So we had to do U.S. filing, U.S. SEC, and then Canadian filing, Canadian laws. So very detailed and time consuming. So we then went out with a binding offer, and the $12 million turned into $2.6 million that we raised. And at the time, it was the second largest raise for Start Engine and the largest raise for a company called Front Funder in Canada. So we had to have two vehicles, two companies. And it ended up with 820 owners. And, you know, they have their priority is last money in, first money out. So they're protected. But they're non-voting. And they're just happier in hell. They love being owners. And I was, every year we have a get together at the resort, and I was there 2 weeks ago, and we had 130 of them came in from New York, Florida, all over Canada and the US. I mean, we ended up raising money in 42 states, every province in Canada, and we had 16 countries, but we only could do Australia because the securities laws in all those other countries prohibited non-accredited investors to invest in something like this. And they're goodwill ambassadors for us. They love being owners, and still today they love it. So what we did with the money, we ended up building this project on the top of the mountain called Constella, which is a 4,000 square foot clubhouse and 8 cabins that sleep 5. Although I just created one of them, 6 cabins. I created one into a honeymoon suite. So
nice.
And but the clubhouse was private for the first couple of years, and I went back to them and I said, you know, it just doesn't make sense being private. I want to open it up to public. And 819 of them said, fine. And and it's a public, beautiful public venue on the top of the mountain, and people spend the night up there and wake up in the morning with snow and have breakfast and start skiing first tracks. So that's what we did with the investment.
So are they investors in a traditional sense where if they want out, they can recoup their investment?
I mean, we're still a private company, so there's no public market to sell. If someone wanted to sell their units, then they would come to us and we'd have a right of first refusal. But no one, actually, that's not true. Unfortunately, a couple people have passed away, so we've facilitated transfers. But they're just thrilled. The average investor was $3,500. And they're just thrilled to be part of this. And in the Crescent, I think a dozen of my Fight the Man owners bought Crescent units.
Oh, wow. So it was a cool experiment and you raised some money. You know, $2 million is not a lot in the context of a ski resort of your size. Do you anticipate doing future rounds? Could this be a bigger part of Red Mountain's operating model in the future?
Never again.
Never again? Why not?
Oh, it's a once in a lifetime. First of all, I had no idea what I was getting into when I did
okay.
it. I didn't think it would resonate the way it did. I'll tell you a funny story. I didn't use a PR company either, and we just spent $1,300 and launched it with an AP release. And 10 days later, the guy calls me up because I've been here for 10 years. I have never seen traction like this. We hit 220 million eyeballs with this $1,300 release around the world.
Unbelievable.
So, you know, it's one of those things that you can never try to repeat yourself. My philosophy is don't go back to the well and try to do the same thing again, because it's typically not going to be as successful. And it's something that doesn't, you know, capital needs, as you say, are a lot greater than that kind of money. And I think that I have no regrets doing it. People are thrilled to be part of it, and they're secure. I mean, their investment is protected.
So you've been very deliberate about the importance of keeping Red Mountain independent. And you mentioned your other two partners, and then you recently welcomed in your first new partner in 20 years. Why is it so important to you, Howard, that Red Mountain stay independent? And what can you tell us about the current partners and the new partners and how they will play into the future of Red?
So my existing partners have been with me 20 years, and there are just 21 of them, and four or five of them have the majority of the investment. And they have allowed me to steer this ship with complete and total support. And they've been in this deal a long time. I am going to be 74 in April, and I have literally worked every month since I got out of law school. So my wife of 45 years has said, it might be time for you to at least, you know, smell the roses a bit before you're in a wheelchair or something. So for me, I can stumble into the new partners. Last March, I got a call from a gentleman named David Evans, who had just tied up a little piece of land outside of our resort and said he wanted to meet me. So I met him. And he and his twin brother, Chris, are from Vancouver, and they both, they're 46, they're twins. They worked for two of the biggest developers in BC for 17, 20 years, developing thousands of high-rise units. But they also are just core adventure people. I mean, my core demographic, Stuart, is 40-something, married, two or three kids. They work out three, four times a week. They love skiing. They love running. They love hiking. They love being in RVs. They love surfing. And they love family. And, you know, these two guys have seven kids between the two of them. And their father was the fifth employee of IntraWest.
Wow.
So he and Joe Hussein were Xerox salesmen before Joe Hussein decided to put together the ski business. So they know the business as well. And we started to get to know each other, and they said, you know, I was going to do this other project. Actually, what I told my wife, the Crescent was the last project I was going to do. But they said, why don't you just do phase two of this Crescent? And I said, well, you know, I'm kind of done raising the money. I'm just going to try to slow down. No, we'll do that. We'd like to be your partners. Long story short, we ended up putting together two partnerships. One is called the Dally, which is on the market today, 94 units, 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms, right next to the Crescent at the base. And then we're launching end of the month, 78 townhomes, which is an expanded piece of property that they had bought, and we added more land to it. And in the last 10 months, I've worked 6-7 days a week with these guys, putting their combined $170 million of real estate together. And they demonstrated incredible passion, hard work, experience, just fantastic young guys. And those are the types of people for me that I didn't know I was looking for it at the time, but in hindsight, I couldn't be more blessed to partner up with two guys that really see my vision and the vision of this community and endorse it and want to be part of it. And so their energy and their youth is really the perfect segue for me in the next year and a half to slow down a bit. And certainly on the real estate side, they'll be much more engaged as they are in these two projects. And then we have plans to get in bed deeper with the overall business and to continue the journey. So when you talk about independence, which you had mentioned, you know, I didn't wake up one morning and say, okay, I am going to be one of those guys that runs the most independent ski resort in North America. You know, we just, you know, every day you go to work and you make decisions that are consistent with your vision and your strategy that account for the personality of the community and its members and accounts for your destination visitor. It, you know, having the privilege of staying independent is something that I've chosen for a while. And I can tell you that there has been an opportunity or two to not be independent. But, and I can't promise you where the future will go with the operating company per se, because you just don't know. But whatever happens, certainly under my watch, it will maintain kind of the ethos and the spirit and the connection to this community.
You know, when you were talking earlier about the old days in Tahoe and those days of skiing in the 60s and 70s, there were tons of founder operators still running their mountains, and there was very little consolidation around the country. We've seen most of the big resorts get bought up. However, some like Jackson Hole, the Kemmerers, who were aging, decided to sell to another local group. So some big independents are staying independent. On the other hand, Alterra Mountain Company, who you partner with on the Icon Pass, obviously, has purchased both Schweitzer and, just last week, Arapahoe Basin over the last year. Curious, Howard, on your perspective as it relates to Red Mountain, as you've watched these various transactions and considered the different ways that Red Mountain could go and thought about kind of your legacy and how what you want to set this place up for, what are your thoughts on these trends we're seeing and what you would like for Red Mountain long term?
Well, the reality is that the pass, whether it's the Epic or the Icon Pass, has radically changed the way consumers experience skiing. And anybody who is an avid skier who wants to ski multiple resorts, there's just no argument against being part of this pass, because the economics are incredible, right? The number of days you have to ski to break even at your local resort is low. And then you have, you know, 7 days on average at, you know, tens upon tens upon tens of ski resorts, you know, in the case of Altera, 50 resorts. And I don't know how many Vail has now, but so that's here to stay. And I felt I had to join one of them, and I was lucky enough to have a good conversation and get admitted as a partner to Icon. And I felt then, and I feel today, that it's been a very good relationship. But not only that, it hasn't negatively impacted our ski experience. In fact, as I said to you earlier, everything we do flows down to the city of Roslyn. When I have a customer that's coming onto the Powder Highway, they're going to go downtown to the brewery or to the chocolate store or to the grocery store or to the bakery. So they're bringing in visitors that otherwise wouldn't come here. It's not impacting the ski experience, which I describe as being able to ski 15,000 feet of untracked before noon without lift lines. And I'm happy with that. And I believe they're happy with us because we have a unique product in their portfolio. And I do know that the people that come here on an Icon Pass stay here longer than most any of their other resorts. So it's good for them and it's good for us. That's part A. Part B is, you know, legacy is not, I'm not looking for a legacy. I'm looking for preserving this endangered species. And there are things that I have done and will do as I wouldn't say fade away in the sunset, but just, you know, start to slow down. I mean, for instance, I've told people that this day lodge and lockers and rafters will never be taken down. Yet to try to project what's going to happen in the next 5 years, I just can't do that, Stuart, because, you know, life is volatile. But what I can say is that I believe that whatever happens, it's going to maintain and preserve what we all love about this resort, and it's going to protect and enhance the community that lives there.
So I want to focus on the Icon Pass for a moment, and it sounds like so far there hasn't been any of the sort of pushback we may have seen in Jackson or Aspen in the early days. I imagine some of that was complicated by the fact that you joined this pass September 1st, 2020, and for a long time the border was closed and folks couldn't really get up to Red Mountain from the United States. I'm curious now, though, because we do see so much of the crowding happening along I-70 in Colorado, around the Wasatch, around Lake Tahoe. Are you getting those Icon adventurers who are figuring out, okay, this place is on my pass, it's 4,000 acres, it's filled with powder and awesome terrain. Are you starting to see more of that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we launched during COVID, right after COVID came. I mean, they couldn't come to Canada.
Right.
And then by the third year, you had to do a PCR test, which was, you know, for a young family, they're not going to spend $800 if there's four of them to come and go skiing before we even go skiing. So last year was a great year for us. I mean, we had fantastic growth with the Icon Pass, and it did not impact our ski experience whatsoever. But it enhanced the economic pocketbooks of every merchant in every part of our community. I mean, to the extent even the guy who owns the legal cannabis store said, thank you. You know, and I know there's a lot of legal cannabis stores all over. So I can't feel bad about that. But I mean, I know that, I mean, it was a rough start, obviously, in December, but we're now seeing Icon people show up because, you know, they come to go on the Powder Highway. And when there's, you know, marginal skiing, as there was in the whole West, they're not booking their trips to go do marginal skiing. They're coming to be, to experience Powder Highway and to experience our resort when it's, you know, prime and when it's shining. And they're there yesterday. I mean, I was told that I think 30% of our retail sales were people who had an Icon pass.
Oh, wow. So you like Icon. Have you considered Mountain Collective? Sun Peaks, Revy, Panorama have all joined that coalition just 2 days instead of the five or seven, no blackouts. Have you had conversations with them? Any interest in that pass?
You know, I just, we're on the Lake Louise pass. We've had that forever. All our Canadian contribution. You know, we're happy with just Icon. I mean, we think it fits our model. It's not, you know, overwhelming our infrastructure. It's not impacting our ski experience. And we're happy with where we are today. And that has no, you know, that's not saying anything derogatory about the Mountain Collective at all.
So as these Icon Pass skiers are showing up, there's a certain expectation that a modern skier who's used to a big resort experience is used to. And I think that most Icon Pass skiers are spoiled with high speed lifts, and that's their expectation. Do you get some surprise looks when they show up to Red Mountain and it's all fixed grip chairs, or do they roll with it and say, okay, this is kind of cool, this is throwback? I always think it's kind of funny because I kind of like slow chairs myself, but some people get really upset about it. So what have you been seeing or hearing as these Icon folks show up over the horizon?
So you need to step back and say to yourself, what is the purpose of a high speed chair? So I would answer that question fundamentally to move people faster at whatever, whether it's a base area or whether it's on the mountain, to minimize or reduce lift lines, but essentially to accelerate the moment you get in line to the moment you get off that chairlift, whichever one it is, to ski, right? That's, to me, the fundamental reason to make that investment. There's other reasons, though. I mean, it's easier for young people, children, to get on. They are a little faster. And in the summer, you know, it can be used for mountain bike parks, et cetera. I go back to, go back to my first observation, to get point to point as fast as you can. So if you decide, Stuart, do you want to ski from 9 to 12 at our resort on a crowded day, you could ski and just get in line at 9. You could ski, if you're just cruising, 15,000 vertical feet of untracked powder with our 16-minute chairlift. Longest chairlift is 16 minutes. And, you know, we're pure 2,500, we're 3,000 vertical, but our main chairlift sits, Granite's 2,500, Gray's 2,000 feet. A perfect fall line. I promise you, by the third chair, you're sitting with me saying, ah, this feels good to just get the legs to relax. So that's point number one. Point number two is we don't have angst at this resort. When the lift lines on a powder day are people who are sharing stories, talking, having their little lattes, because they know they're going to get as much powder as they want in that morning. And therefore, we just don't have that tension. And the third part of it is it engages our community with people who are visiting. You're sitting on this chair, you get to know someone, you're going to end up at a bar or at someone's house. It happens all the time. So if you're looking for if you just have to have the newness, if you like to rush your life, and our life is being rushed in so many ways and distracted in so many ways, you know, our view of the experience is slow down, reduce your blood pressure, don't get hung up on the newness of everything. Just try to enjoy the beauty of the alpine at a pace that, frankly, you're not used to, which is just relaxed, enjoyable, without tension. So having said that, as our base area builds, we know that we're going to need to put a high speed at the base for as much the summer component as it's the winter component. But I mean, there was a woman who was there with me a couple weeks ago, and we had, you know, it was a crowded day for us. Every parking space was full, powder day. And she finished her ski day and she goes, "Where was everybody?" And that's the experience that we have. That's why this guy said to me, "This was the greatest day I've ever had, and I've skied all of North America." So, and we have the ability to maintain that ski experience because we still have plenty of two in particular mountains that we can open up. Because that's one of our strategic imperatives is we're going to maintain the skier acres per skier. And or put another way, keep it uncrowded, right? And let people enjoy this mountain. So yeah, I mean, I'm not against high speeds, by the way. They become very expensive. It's something we know we're going to have sooner than later. But when you just look at the fundamental reason why people are there, you just, if you have a 5 minute, 10 minute lift line for me with a 16 minute chair, and you look at resorts that we don't need to name that have longer lines with all high speeds, mm-hmm. the net, I'm on the top of that mountain before anybody.
Yeah. One of my favorite hacks is when there's a high speed lift and a fixed grip lift running next to it, and the high speed will have a huge line and people are all bundled around it, and the fixed grip has no line. And I'll just take the fixed grip because I'll take a slow chair with no line over a fast chair with a long line any day. Surveying your lift fleet here, Howard, it's an eclectic fleet. You have machines from all different manufacturers, Poma, Yant, Yokel, Mueller, Doppelmayr. The oldest ones date to the 70s. Red is a 1971 Mueller double. T-Bar is also of that vintage. The Paradise Triple is a Yant machine from 1976. Kind of just thinking broadly, what's your wish list, Howard, for what you would like to upgrade or replace at some point in the foreseeable future?
Well, yeah, in the kind of short to midterm, either a new fixed grip or high speed at the base silver load chair, and then replace the Paradise chair with that fixed grip quad that we have today at the base. That to me are the two must-haves in the future. And then the nice to have would be open up Kirk up with another chairlift and just, you know, turn this thing from spectacular to, you know, beyond spectacular.
So right now, Kirkup has cat skiing, which is super cool. I believe it's $10. Correct me if that price has changed. But your master plan shows potential lift expansions, as you mentioned, on Kirkup, but also on Mount Roberts and White Wolf Ridge. Just lay this out for us, Howard. What can you tell us about your ambitions to expand onto those and what the sequence might be and what it would take to make those expansions happen with lift service?
Yeah, the beauty of our governance with the Crown and with the city is that, you know, we have approval for those lifts. I mean, obviously you have to go through what they call DP development permits, but let's start with Mount Roberts. I mean, it's an incredible mountain. It's a 30-minute skin right from the base of Paradise. It's in an old growth forest. It's really a sacred place. And I personally don't see us putting a lift on that mountain.
Kirkup, sacred in what way? I'm sorry, Howard. Sacred in what way?
It's a community local go-to place. Mm-hmm. And it's spectacular. But I would like to see that just preserved as that 30-minute skin into an old-growth forest. And if you want to experience it, you got to hike it. White Wolf Ridge, which is between Mount Roberts and Record, that's a different story. That's a beautiful gladed area. I could see in the next 5 years a chairlift up there, access, you know, through paradise. Beautiful intermediate tree scheme. And then Kirkup, which actually on a priority standpoint, I Kirkup would go first. That is, you know, we do cat skiing there. We raised it to $20 Canadian. But that is an area that will be accessed from the Topping Creek portal, Topping Creek parking lot, and that to us. And within my time here, I could see, you know, adding that chairlift as the next chairlift at this resort. And that would just take this place to a, it's already at that level, but it's just adding on to it. Spectacular, spectacular skiing.
What kind of lift are you thinking, a fixed quad over there?
Yeah. I mean, Stuart, these chairlifts are like $8-9 million for a high-speed quad. I remember the first time I quoted it, it was like $4 million.
Right.
So, I mean, we $9 million is a lot of money for us. And we have to just allocate, you know, what's best for this resort, not just in the winter, but in, as I said to you earlier, we are now really going to focus on the other three seasons of the year, which are spectacular here. And that's what we do. We have to look at the pros and cons of every dollar we invest. And we are really going to focus on starting next summer on the other four seasons. When we finish the Crescent, we're going to develop a four-season plaza at the base. And we're looking at some other things that I think, you know, will really be advantageous, you know, to people who are buying condominiums at a resort and also for the people who live in Roslyn.
And then with White Wolf Ridge, what's the vertical back there?
Probably under 1,000.
Looks like a nice intermediate pod.
Oh, it's just beautiful. Beautiful. And then, and Kirkup's 2,000.
Mm. And with Mount Roberts, it sounds like you're not interested in putting that lift there. How about a cat? Once you get a lift on Kirkup, could you move the cats over to Mount Roberts, or do you like that as a skinning experience?
Skinning experience.
So looking at just potential future developments, there's no access right now between Red and Granite Mountains. Why is it that you can't ski between? Is that something you could resolve with some runs or surface lifts, or is there some sort of reason why that's not a bridgeable gap?
There's really no reason why you would want to bridge that. I mean, if you look at the mountains we have, when you come to the base, to the left is Red Mountain. So that is called 1700 feet vertical. You ski 270 degrees off of that mountain. And that's where we now host, you know, all of our racing. We have snowmaking all the way to the top of the backside of Red. But to bridge the gap over to Granite, to Red, it just doesn't make sense. When you look at how our mountains are connected, you have Red, and next to it is Granite. And behind Granite is Roberts and Record. And between those is White Wolf. Then to the north is Gray. And then to the north of that is Kirkup. And down below, Gray is Topping. But that doesn't add anything to the customer experience. It actually is kind of an awkward thought, not to be critical of you, but
all fair. All right, let's wrap up here today with a pitch for the Powder Highway. Howard, you are the southernmost, as I mentioned in the intro, stop on the Powder Highway. For folks, for listeners who are not familiar with the Powder Highway and what it is, tell us about this legendary area and why they ought to start at Red Mountain.
Well, I mean, it's where the region that we are in the Monashee Mountains in the Southeast Kootenays, is some of the first and original cat and hilly skiing. The amount of snow and the variety of mountains in this region is really stunning. And especially the kind of skiing and the kind of beauty of these mountains. The name, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, we certainly didn't coin the Powder Highway, but what we did do is we called ourselves the first stop on the Powder Highway. And we did that because we're the closest ski resort in Canada from America. So we're only 9 miles across the border and we're 2.5 hours from Spokane. And, you know, there's 40 million people can fly direct to Spokane from the United States. So it's a logical first stop. When you look at, you know, I'm looking at it, it's red. Within an hour of us is Whitewater. That's, I would call that the second stop on the Powder Highway. It depends which way you go, but if you're going west, then you hit Revelstoke, Kicking Horse, Panorama, Kimberley, and Fernie in the back. Or you could come into the Alberta side and reverse it. Those resorts, those mountains are spectacular. The beauty is incredible. The variety of skiing is spectacular as well. And can I say also Canadian, and with the Canadian charm at all of these places, and with a variety of skiing and challenge. So it's so unique. And, you know, you can come to Red, and if you just did Red Mountain, Whitewater, and Revelstoke, that's one trip out of Spokane. I mean, it's spectacular. We're 4 hours from Revelstoke. We're an hour from Whitewater. And it's becoming, I think, you know, Ski British Columbia is the one that coined this thing and started pushing it out. But it's the real deal, Stuart. I mean, these places are, you know, each resort has its own elements that are unique and compelling.
And not a lot of neighbors, right? When you're out there, you pretty much got them to yourself, right?
Oh, I mean, when you look at these, I mean, there are some, you know, every resort has its kind of touch points, right? I mean, I can't say, you know, I'm not going to opine about each resort and their crowds and their costs, et cetera, right? They're all legitimate, fantastic mountains. And like any place, you get there at the right day, show up at the right day. I mean, that's what it's all about. It's like going surfing. You go over to Fiji and you're hoping there's waves. Well, you come to the Powder Highway and you hope there's powder. So but yeah, I mean, this whole area of British Columbia is just spectacular. And Alberta, right? So yeah, I'm proud to be part of it.
All right, Howard, let's walk off on that. I will give you your day back. I appreciate all the time and insight you've given us here today on Red Mountain. Just an awesome, awesome, special place. So thank you very much for your perspective. I really, really appreciate it. And I know the listeners will as well.
Well, thank you, Stuart. And thanks for the time.
That's Howard Katkov, CEO and Chairman of Red Mountain, British Columbia. That was just terrific, Howard. Thank you so much for sharing the story of that very unique mountain. And thank you all for listening. Lots more pods on the calendar. I've added a few new ones in recent days, including conversations with retiring Gunstock GM Tom Day, Jackson Hole President Mary Kate Buckley, and Chip Chase, founder of the incredible Whitegrass Touring Center in West Virginia. Those and lots more coming your way over the next few months. Please visit stormskiing.com to subscribe to the Storm Skiing newsletter and ensure you get new podcasts the moment they're live. New pods appear in your email box several hours before syncing with key podcast services, including Apple and Spotify. There are free and paid tiers of the newsletter, and paid subscribers receive podcasts 7 full days before everyone else. You can also follow The Storm on X and Instagram at Stormski Journal. Until next time, stay well, stay safe. I'm Stuart Winchester, and I'll talk to you again very soon.
The Storm Skiing Podcast is a Quicksilver Films production.